What browser do you use then? Because as a fairly tech-savvy guy, you would seem to be the type who might use an Opera or as opposed to, say, a default Chrome or Safari.
All right, Vivaldi or Brave. I actually do use Brave a whole lot. I like it. There's some questionable stuff about the leadership. They kind of split off from Firefox.
Okay.
Back, I forgot how long ago it was, but it was kind of just in the tech world because they felt like Firefox was too woke, kind of a thing. So Brave was kind of this, privacy first thing, and they still do that. But then there's little things about it, like they part of their gamification thing is if you opt in, you don't have to. You can basically any coin you want, and then reward people that you visit often or sites you visit often, which is an old thing going back to a browser called Flock, like in 2009 or 10, which I did love.
What?
Yeah, but now Brave is Chromium based, not like Firefox, not using that
Okay.
engine. So I like Brave a lot when I have to use Chromium. I'm not a Google Chrome fan, really. So I've actually, with the iOS 26 betas and stuff that I've been running this summer, I've actually switched everything back to Safari because the new updates are, yeah, the new iOS updates and Mac OS updates and iPad over there are superb. But I think it's a big step up for the operating system. So some of the
Oh.
changes in Safari I've really liked. So I've been running that, and it hasn't really hit many snags. And I'm locked in. But then I've got my Linux machine over there that runs a Chromium fork. That's based on Linux free protocols and that kind of stuff. So I'm not really locked in unless it really is Safari, I guess, because I'm so dependent on Mac OS.
It's like the whole Firefox, or maybe open source because it's forkable. Maybe it's a bit like Protestantism, where people can be like, "Oh, I'm going to do my own slightly different thing." Whereas,
That's it.
say, Google
Yeah.
Chrome is the unified Catholic Church. Maybe Safari is a slightly smaller Eastern Orthodox Church or Orthodox Church.
I would say, yeah, I would say, okay, yeah, because I've been in these wars since the 90s. I was a big Netscape fan, Navigator, and way back when you had to pay for it. I was like a freshman in college, and we had a lab that had free Netscape Navigator for students, and I was like, oh my gosh, they're a Navigator. So then Internet Explorer came out and took over the world. So I think they're kind of like the Catholic Church. And then when Chrome started, like in, what was that, 2007, 2008,
Seven? Yeah, somewhere in there.
we started getting the good stuff. And I immediately switched over. I worked for Google for a little bit and all that stuff. So I was heavy in, Gmail and cloud services and all that thing. And people thought I was nuts at the time, but I remember watching the charts as Chrome gained adoption.
It was a really remarkable. It was a, I don't know, unprecedented.
Yeah, so I've always thought of Chrome kind of like the upstart Protestant side that now has all the forks. But when they started up, they were kind of the cool kids, and it was the browser you try to get your mom or grandma to use, and it was like, no, this is a much better browser than Internet Explorer, and so but now Chrome is bloated, and there's all kinds of sketchy things sometimes, and you're not really sure who to trust. So it reminds me of, kind of evangelical Protestantism that I'm a part of, with all the sketchiness and fundamentalism and those things that go along with it. But I mean, nothing wrong with Chrome and Chromium stuff. They are good browsers, and I just don't trust some big tech companies with all of our data still, especially now with AI, doing what it's doing. And you hear the horror stories about security, privacy, but just in general, I think it's fascinating to see Google, really pushing Gemini everywhere. Microsoft has Copilot, and then we have, OpenAI and Mistral and Cloud and all these, Claude, I should say, and Perplexity, which is in the news this week for being sketchy. So it's definitely a new iteration of all that. And I've always been kind of, a tech nerd, so I'm excited to see how it plays out, even though I feel ontological angst after playing with GPT-5 the last few hours today. It's been been fun to poke around with, and feels like all those things we're saying 10 years ago about us not really using the web as we know it, but interfacing with the web, not as humans looking at a web page with, pretty cats, memes, and that kind of stuff, but relying on something to read the web for us. So now we have, these various agents and services, and I really think that what we were saying 10 years ago about, why Facebook Messenger is the future of the web, or why something like WeChat or WhatsApp are going to be the next big platform. Now that really is kind of the case, and I think that's why people like Elon Musk are wholeheartedly throwing so much money and time at things like Grok, because they know that not only AI
Oh,
going to be a thing in and of
that's the
itself,
intermediary. That's the medium
but
is the message kind of a thing.
you're not going to go to either Chrome or GPT. You're going to go to that one spot. So you're going to go to Grok, or you're going to go to whatever OpenAI names their thing that's going to be their brand, which they're trying to do now. So that instead of logging into instead of logging into ChatGPT and seeing five different models to pick from, it automatically puts you, sorry, had a little blip there. It automatically puts you in, and we're glitching again. Our internet has been up and down all week, and now it's jacked up again. It automatically puts you at GPT-5, and then it kind of decides which models to use. So I think that's the next iteration. So web design and SEO and all that stuff is going to go from being human focused to really being ways to get sucked up by whatever AI services are that people are using, or whichever, two, three shake out as the top ones. And that's a hot new thing in the marketing tech world, is like getting your site indexed by ChatGPT. So it's fun to see that kind of come full circle, but also scary, because the web as we know it will not be the same web in 5 years.
Well, it's I notice it when searching for like I don't know, handy tips around the house for very basic I don't know, home renovation. It's not even renovation level, but handy tips around the house, and clearly the websites are optimized for Google search because they have a particular structure of like, what is it, how is it different? And it's like seven paragraphs later, I get the answer I want, but it has been optimized for a search engine as opposed to, what a human would ask for. And then I guess we're going to go through this whole thing again with whatever indexing an AI agent would use.
Exactly. So, I mean, recipe sites are the worst. So now you've got everything from the New York Times to, I don't even know the top recipe sites, all recipes or whatever, but they all write in this kind of narrative format that tells a story. And then you have the ingredient list, and then you have a little bit more story. And then you get to, okay, turn your oven on, but you've already scrolled for like 30 seconds, So, and that's all written for SEO, and things like that are going to change, but we're going to see a lot more listicles and a lot less, a lot fewer fonts, a lot fewer images. It's going to go kind of back to BBS days and being very text heavy, I think.
I guess because the well, I would AI agents not be able to put out graphics? I guess they could, but
They could,
it's
but
not at the
for
moment.
right now, yeah, that's not what people are looking for. People are generating graphics, but for right now, people aren't going to those places and saying, show me a
To
picture of
look for
cats.
graphic.
Right. But they will generate them, generate a picture of a cat in the style of, whatever comic we want to create. So I think, I think it's going to be really fascinating. And even on, my blog, I've seen an uptick in traffic from ChatGPT. Like, I could see various agents and things that are heading to your site. And just watching that traffic increase has been really interesting, because most of what I post is either just short, idiotic things I think of, or, like papers and long form stuff that I'm working on for research. So it's kind of fun to see what gets picked up.
That's really cool.
And, I get people want to block AI stuff, especially, if you're doing academic research and you don't necessarily want that to show up and get copy and pasted. But it's one of the reasons I put it on the web. I've published in journals that are offline, and I've got a few over there, and they're great, but they're
Offline
going
journals still exist? I had no idea.
to, yeah, it's that right here. This is, AAR. We get four of these a year for the American Academy of Religion, and I was in one of those last year. And they're cool, and you can find the references and the citations online. But for the most part, you have to have university access or whatever to get
Got it.
in. So that kind of writing is one thing, but what, 20, 50, 100 maybe people will see that, and maybe
Yeah.
five will actually read it. So,
Right.
it's one of those things where it's like, and I get it. I'm all about authenticity and keeping things off the web. But sometimes, you have a good idea and you want it to get out there, so might as well put the oil in the machine and see what kind of
Right.
seeds it can germinate.
Makes me think of vinyl, the records, because they have seen a steady uptick in the past number of years. They're nowhere close to their old peak. But I think I read that vinyl sales may have exceeded CD sales because
They did,
everyone who is of the
yeah.
CD generation has gone off to streaming, or in some cases, like me, buying digital music. But the textural or the physical experience of, oh, this is a vinyl record, and I guess it is still meaningful for some folks. And that reminds me of your offline journal there.
I've got a few of those. No, I've got a CD sitting right here. I'm still
Oh, yeah.
plugging along to Waylon Jennings Live. Yeah, I've got a huge stack of CDs going back to college, and we have a vinyl record player right behind me.
Oh,
We've
wow.
got a few hundred records over there on the shelves. Yeah, so a lot of classics and or classical and jazz type stuff, not classics, but I like it for our children to be able to, pick up a vinyl record, and our 6-year-old loves doing it, and now she's much more gentle after, chopping a few. But the
Right.
process of putting the thing on the record player and finding the right spot for the needle and all that stuff, it makes you want to sit down and really listen to the album. And I've got Spotify and Apple Music and all Tidal and all that stuff, and I love Spotify. It's wonderful for what it is, but music is so important to me that like I want to make sure that I'm not just renting it or leasing it. And if there's a really good Thelonious Monk album or something like that, or Willie Nelson album, I'm gonna have that on vinyl. Or when one of my favorite bands puts out something, I'm gonna try to get it on vinyl because it helps them more than just me streaming it a couple times over
Yeah, for
Spotify and
sure.
not really paying attention. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of, like you said, definitely with vinyl, but even with CDs, I've heard and just seen on places like Reddit, there's a lot of interest in getting back into that, and they're super cheap now because everyone gave them away 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and so I don't know. I think physical media is gonna not make a comeback, but I think it's gonna be a status symbol in a way that it
I
hasn't
think so,
been.
yeah.
So like we still have way too many books, and people will come over and comment like, oh my gosh, you have a lot of books. It's like, yeah, and we've read, a good portion of them, not all of it. But it's not just for decoration anymore, I don't think. And I think a lot of younger people are getting tired and overwhelmed with paying, 20, $25 for Spotify without ads and that kind of thing. So we'll see. I hope people go back to physical media. I loved going to Best Buy or the local record shop and, flipping through the stands and finding the CD you wanted. So we'll see.
Like that actually goes back to that Cobb quotation. The design should privilege adaptability over rigid optimization. I would assume your rigid optimization would be digitize all media, but then there will always be people, who value different experiences or different, well, in your in many people's cases, actual ownership as opposed to renting or leasing a service, which might, for any reason, remove media. I don't know, that points back to this, what, integral ecology, I suppose. Yeah, the convergent framework.
Yeah, it was this paper. I was invited to send a paper. It's for a tech conference next year, but they are looking at various viewpoints on things like artificial intelligence and kind of bigger picture things about what should we consider that we haven't considered. So this one is not just environmental impact and that kind of stuff, but it's sort of a more philosophical ecology based on the notion that ecology is not just about what we consider nature or the environment, which a lot of people seem, but it has more to do with our place in the cosmos or the universe or
Right.
here on Earth. And integral ecology really is sort of the understanding that we are an integral part of our surroundings and our surroundings are an integral part of us and what all that means. So thinking about AI as a vehicle of intelligence, even if it's we don't consider it intelligent being yet, what does that mean on the ecological side? And some of that is environmental, but a lot of it's just sort of the way we think about ourselves as human. And we are constantly infatuated, even from early ages, with questions like, do are dogs intelligent, or are whales intelligent, or dolphins, or bats, or whatever, right? And my kids asked all the time, like, well, is ladybug intelligent if you say a tree is intelligent? I'm like, well, yeah. And that definition is still kind of blurry. So thinking about artificial intelligence, what does that mean from an ecological point of view? And yeah, this paper is kind of technical because it is for a technical audience, but I'm really fascinated by what's going to happen on that front, because I think we focus so much on the tech side and the sort of reductive and I don't know, extractive side of this concept of artificial intelligence. What does it do for us? What can we get from it? And I'm not saying we have to think about what we need to do for it, because we're giving lots of money and resources, but thinking about that concept of artificial intelligence from a more humane and ecological point of view, I think is really fun philosophically. So that's where that comes from, and it's fun to write. I think a lot of people are starting to wake up to that as we build more data centers and use more water and minerals and those types of things to make these things work. And I hear all the time now, well, I'm not going to use AI because it's such an extractive resource, and it is, and we need to get over that and figure something out. But it's not going to stop. So unless so unless we provide some answers, I don't know if we're going to be able to necessarily prevent that course from happening.
It makes me think of a so my notion is that you have some fast-moving companies trying to build out AI at any expense to establish an early lead, something like this, maybe a permanent lead. And then afterwards, you might have some slower moving people who are, I don't know, more efficient or more judicious or more socially aware or conscientious about things. And that makes me think of there's this thing in biology called the RK theory, R/K theory. And it's two different survival strategies where R is high reproductive rate, but very low survival. So, like a fish, lays 1,000 eggs, and then hopefully one or maybe two of those fertilized eggs winds up surviving all the way into adulthood and reproducing. And the K selection is where you have very few offspring, but you put a lot of effort into making sure their survival rates are high. So like humans or bears, I don't know, large mammals, a whale, I guess, might only have a baby every several years. And if I remember correctly, the R species, when there's a new ground, like maybe after forest fire, the R species spread first because they're the fastest to reproduce. And they eventually get edged out by the K species, who are more, they don't spread as fast, but they're more maybe efficient or something with the resources. And that sounds to me like there could be a loose parallel with, I'm sure everyone, well, everyone, all five companies or whoever, we're working on AI are trying to build out as fast as possible so they don't get left in the dust. And then it would only be later that you have fuller consideration of, well, how do we structure this to have the least negative impact? Because at the moment, it's just like who can reproduce or who can build out as many data centers as fast as possible to avoid to get as high a market share and not be one of the also-rans who's rounding error on the scope of things.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And the people who are investing so much money into it, which is most every tech company that is watching the news, they're doing so not just to be first, I guess, but to have a stake in what is inevitable, and then having that little carved out piece is so important. So I don't think we're going to see kind of what we had in the late 90s, as the web became a thing in the mainstream, where you have Microsoft's, getting broken up by the Department of Justice here because, it was too big, right? They're going to have to spin off Internet Explorer and all sorts of things. So I don't think we're going to see that kind of a situation because the current administration is not big on that, but also because I think the market has changed in terms of how people rely on access to information. And we've gone through 25 solid years, almost 30 years now, of mainstream adoption of the internet. And, whether it's cell phones or, whatever form factor is next, people are, I think, not turning towards more humane systems, but I think people want to get away from screens. And as younger generations continue to mature and become the buying class, which I hate that term, but you hear it. I think that market is going to sort of go from being something where you're marketed at to something where you are interacting on a humane level with the interface, but also with people in a non-screen version, if that makes sense. So all that to say, I think we're going to drop the screens, and I think something like AI-driven technology is going to be the interface. So I don't think we're going to be carrying iPhones and sitting in front of laptops in 10 years. And I think the way we do computing is going to be radically different. There will be people that still have mainframes and all that kind of stuff. I'm not, of course, there will always be those edge cases who need Excel for whatever reason. But, and the engineers and the people that work in the mainframes at banks and all that. But what we're going to see is going to be so dramatic. And we're forgetting about the exponential curve, I think, with things like AI. I think we're still very close to the XY axis there of zero rather than being on the upswing of that curve. So as job trends form and as things start getting weird, I think that notion is going to be different. So all that to say, I don't think GPT-5 is going to be the winner and Grok's going to suck and be out of business in 5 years. I think they'll have their niches, and that's why I think people are pouring into it because of that.
I do. I remember speaking with a, I think it was a sociologist, a PhD student, who explained that it was common to use AI when they were doing their related background reading. So this would be something which only absorbs the information from whatever PDFs you upload. But for your thesis topic, you might get 80 texts, and then you upload them all, and then you say, what are the general themes of these authors and how might they pertain to topic XYZ. And he said that you'd still read the text, but you'd prioritize the ones which were cited most frequently, or the themes which were cited most frequently in this digest, maybe, of all 80 papers, or whatever the number was, of papers, which I thought was very useful and would eliminate, or at least super reduce, the risk of, I don't know, someone on Reddit makes a joke post about eating, I don't know, eating books or something, and then somehow that creeps in because it happened to fit the right notes for a summary. So yeah, I can see that the synthesis aspect of the tool is very useful, and if it's useful, it's going to get used, and so it will be a different landscape.
Yeah, and I think people still feel that it's more intimate than a Google search, because now we realize a Google search is not just on your laptop or just on your browser, because they're everywhere. So I think that people are right now still saying like, hey, my 6-year-old has a 102-degree temperature and she's been coughing, but she says she feels fine. What should I do? And that's not always met with a great response. But I think people are doing that a whole lot. I've got friends who are really health conscious, and their big thing is to get their blood panels and upload those, which is kind of scary. And instead of
Blood
going,
panel or blood testing results or something?
So here in the US at least, there are labs that will take your blood and kind of give you a panel or levels for various things. And because our healthcare system is so wonderful here. So we have to do it ourselves. We don't have doctors to read those for us, and if we do, it's $18,000. But yeah, I've never done it, but my wife had her panels drawn for her last position, and she was like, should I put it in FBT? And I was like, I'm not really sure about that. But a lot of people, will upload the PDF and say, hey, here's my weight, here's my height, I'm this old, I here's any conditions I've had, but tell me what vitamins I need to take and what exercises I need to do. And it spits out pretty interesting information there for people without having to go to a primary care physician here, which is an ordeal unless you're affluent and privileged. So there's a lot of that, kind of thing happening as well. So again, I think that's why that whole era of tech stuff where if you want to check in, you go to Foursquare. If you want to make a short thing to people, you go to Twitter, and Facebook is for you and your college friends. I think that's really kind of shifting to you have a problem and or a question and you want solved, but you don't want to have to go through, Google search or anything like that. The writing's been on the wall, and Google realized that 15 years ago when they started putting the little snippets. And I remember being a classroom teacher in, gosh, 2020, well, 2021, it was after COVID. And you'd walk by and ask a question, and a student would Google something, and they would copy and paste the little snippet from the top of the search result before Gemini. And you're like, no, that's just a summation that Google's doing based on the top two or three results. Like, don't use that. That's not a source. But Google said it. I'm like, Google's not a thing. And that's literacy. But I just think, we're getting to the point now where you can do that. And that little chat interface that we all thought was going to be kind of a WeChat type system is actually, AI, AGI.
That the relying on the on a an AI or a chat bot for medical advice might be less bad than if you wind up on a highly optimized for search website for some medical quack or something. In that sense,
All right.
it could be a slightly reduced risk because you could go to somewhere which is 100% wrong, or in the probability, the AI might not get everything right depending on how it prioritizes stuff, but you at least, well, probably wouldn't be 100% wrong based on the diversity of data that it is ingested.
Yeah, I mean, Grok trying to be Mecha Hitler a couple of weeks ago, withstanding. That was crazy. I'm interested to see how that works for people's news consumption, as we, live through this era of social media consumption for news, and people have gone away from the big three networks here, and reading newspapers and that kind of thing, which are always skewed and had bias and all that stuff, as we know. But this current era is just untenable, and I think a lot of people are turning to things like AIs to say, is this true? Or hey, I read that Joe Biden is a puppy killer and shoots puppies on his farm in South Dakota because they don't like them. Is that true? And AI comes back and says, no, that's Governor Kristi Noem, who's now Homeland Security Secretary. So,
Yes. And Bruce Lee parodied on South Park this week, apparently.
that's great. I've got to catch up on the new season. I hear it's amazing, but, yeah, we're definitely at this weird transition period, and we'll look back on this in 5, 10 years and say, wow, why didn't we see this coming? Or, how did the things fall into place like they did? Because I think it's going to happen quickly in terms of everything from environmental impact to especially things like labor and employment here in the United States. That's the big worry, because we're already seeing lots of layoffs in the tech side, but we're going to see that increasingly in various sectors. And if we get robots with AI in the factories and that kind of thing, not that we have hundreds of millions of people working in factories, but it's going to be interesting to see how quickly those things happen, because I think they will with the current sort of capitalistic oligarchy setup that we have going. It's profit driven, and you can extract a lot more profit if you have fewer meatbag humans to
Of
take care
course,
of.
yeah, that's right. I did get told someone from a climate-related newsletter that I followed for a long time. Never bought a subscription, but followed. And apparently, all the employees get a what, $300 per month subscription to some sort of AI tool. And when I compare it to the $300 versus not paying anything, well, that's kind of expensive. But then, if you think of it as, an intern, a co-op, someone who you might not trust to do full work, but who can do those sort of early mundane tasks to reduce the time spend of your more expensive employees, your experts, then yeah, I could see $300 a month, even between a few people, being cheaper than hiring one person at thousands of dollars per month, because they have to stay alive well enough for you to be able to have them come in and do their work. So that is definitely a difference.
Right. And now things like GPT have agentic agent or agentic parts, or they call them agents, to go out and do tasks for you, and can take over your desktop if you'd like, and fill out Excel sheets if you need to, or whatever. So yeah, the idea of hiring middle management or $70,000 a year or US dollar employee to be sort of cog in the wheel is going to go away. And I think that's one of the big implications, just in terms of people not thinking this through. It's not going to be blue collar jobs. And again, I hate that term as well, but it's not going to be the welders and the steel fabricators. It's going to be people sitting in offices for 8 hours a day who take, 40 hours a week, and they then get weekends and 2 weeks paid vacation. I think that's what's going to shake things up, and I don't know where that goes when that happens, but there's no turning back in a way. I just read Ursula Le Guin's book, Always
Sure.
Coming Home, and it's set sort of in the future. We're not really sure what happened. There was a collapse, and she follows a group of people in sort of the ruins of Northern California, and we would describe them as native or indigenous people in so many regards. And they basically are more advanced, which is a clumsy word to use there, but more advanced than we are. But they keep finding artifacts from, this plastic generation. And it's a really fascinating book, because it feels like you're reading something about 14th century North America, and all of a sudden, you're in the 22nd century. So it's a nice sci-fi, but they have this conception of the AI system and the web and all that kind of stuff, where they can go look up things, or if they want to put a memory into the memory, it's called, you can access it, but it's kind of this part of town over there locked away, and no one sits there and uses it all day. It's just there, but life happens over here. And I've always been a big Le Guin fan, but I think that would be a fun pathway for us to get to eventually. And it's post-capitalist and post-extractive, and everything's a little more human. So
That
I'm holding out hope that we get there, but yeah.
sounds a bit like a I don't know, an ancient civilization where the small priesthood actually knows, you know, how to read the divine signs in the skies or whatever, and everyone else kind of scrapes out living. There's a holy place for the priests to do their arcane rituals and so forth. I guess that speaks to that saying about how advanced technology seems like magic if you don't if you don't understand
Right.
how it works.
Yeah, exactly. And the way she sets it up, it's a very egalitarian and non-hierarchical sense. But yeah, that conception could definitely have the priest at the center of the temple and, eating all the good meat and writing in hieroglyphics and sacred writing, and the rest of us writing in demonic and not understanding what the hieroglyphs mean. So
I read, I read,
I don't know.
oh, go ahead.
No, yeah, I was, go ahead. You got it.
So I read Frankenstein this week, a remarkably short book. I'd never read it before, but because of AI being in the discourse, I thought, well, you know, this is a pre-2001 HAL computer. I was surprised that like it was written in the early 1800s, and so some of the like standardized spellings we now have in English for city names hadn't been standardized. So like Mainz in Germany, Mainz. In the book, they spelled it Mayence. It was a fun little game to try and guess what town are they referring to.
All right.
My impression of Frankenstein had been like some guy creates this monster, lightning strike, monster comes to life, and it's a horror film. But it was very philosophical, actually. First off, no lightning. He just in one paragraph, I put the last piece in the next paragraph, and you know the beast opens his eyes. But it was really it was an interesting, I don't know, a meditation on what it means to create stuff and what it would be for a non-human intelligent creature to try to navigate the world where everyone's going to be afraid of him. There's a sequence where Frankenstein's monster learns human culture in words by sort of listening in at night on these villagers on some remote hilltop. And it reminded me perfectly of the old what was his name? Burroughs, the Tarzan books. And
Oh,
Tarzan, you know,
yeah,
goes
Edgar
into
Rice
that place and
Burroughs.
he learns, yeah, that's the guy. And then so Tarzan learns to, you know, he in this case, Tarzan learns to read by looking at, I don't know, little picture books that he had as an infant, but he doesn't know how to speak. And in the Frankenstein monster case, for a while, he knows how to speak. You know, he knows what human words would mean, but he doesn't actually know how to write because no one's taught any of the people he's observing how to write. But it was shockingly profound and enjoyable and wrestling with ideas, as compared to what I expected, which would be this monster gets created and just starts, you know, being willfully destructive. Nice little symmetry with Genesis, Adam and Eve. It's like, hey, you got to make me a female partner, then we can live, you know, happily together. We don't have to scare these humans. And eventually, Frankenstein, the creator, is like, I don't want, you know, what if she doesn't, you know, want to live peacefully? What if she wants to destroy this? He's halfway through building the monster's bride, and then he destroys it, and the monster gets his revenge. So it was a really interesting read. And maybe the last thing I'll put is that it's a bit like the movie Inception, because it starts from a guy, a sailor in the north, and the sailor meets Frankenstein. Frankenstein then has his story told, and then he then until one point where he confronts the monster, and then you get Frankenstein's monster's version told to Frankenstein, who is telling the story to the other sailor, and then it goes from the monster's story back to the Frankenstein story back to the other sailor story. So it's a really, really, it was a lot more, it was a lot richer of a reading experience than I thought I would get just from like, okay, I've never read this thing. It has come sort of monster figure. It was very enjoyable. Highly recommended. And short too. It's like at my screen setting on Kindle on my phone, it was like 232 pages.
I know. Every time I read on a Kindle, I'm like, okay, how many pages does this
Does this
translate into in
translate?
real life? Right? No, that's okay. So Frankenstein, and I had to write that down in one of my paper notebooks. So Frankenstein, as a precursor to what we consider AI, is a really fun thread because just a few years later. Oh, man, I can't re believe I'm forgetting her name. We get the first
Mary Shelley?
kind of no. She did a computational machine. It was basically the first computer in the
Oh, okay.
1840s, I believe. Oh gosh, I
Yeah,
can't
that's
believe I'm
not long
blanking on her
after.
name.
That's like 20 years.
Yeah,
I know there was
and
some named Babbage, but that might not be
it's close. It's something like, no, so yeah, Charles Babbage basically took her work and improved on it.
Ada Lovelace, maybe in the
Yes,
US.
Lovelace. That's it. That's it. Yep. I think that's 1830s, 40s, somewhere in there.
Yeah, 18. That's what it looks like here. Yeah.
Okay. Still remember a little bit. So you're getting, that really fascinating thread there, but you can trace that back into ancient mythology as well with the notion of Athena having these avatars that sometimes appear as mechanical in a way. Yeah, the mechanical trolls that you hear about in psychedelic studies coming out of Norse ritual and that kind of stuff. I think there's something there about Frankenstein and what we consider AI now, because if you think about the humane side of what we're constructing with this monster, we're not, maybe we're teaching it to read, who knows, behind closed doors what's going on, but read and think in the way that we consider intelligence and empathy and more kind of human level emotion, and what that means, or should we teach such things at, because you can argue no. And did Frankenstein's monster know that it was alive, and how did it comprehend that, and what did it think of that? Yeah,
And it
that's
was
really cool. It's a
painted
really
too,
interesting
right?
thread.
Like it's
Yeah, exactly.
the monster is, I guess you'd say, it was traumatized by the fact that, its first moments, it wakes up, it sees its creator, and its creator's like, "Oh my God, you're terrible! What a, what an abomination!" And
What did I do?
so, it's like, it learns what hatred of itself or hatred for itself. It's a really curious. It's messy in a way that HAL 9000 2001 is completely like clean. It's just like, I'm a machine, I do these things. Oh, and it happens that I overrule, my mission is more important than the survival of humans. And whereas the monster clearly has emotions and sympathies and empathies, and I wonder if, was it like I suspect that consciousness is some sort of, what's it called, an emergent phenomenon. Like,
Yeah, right.
one
Yeah.
neuron can't be conscious, but if you have enough of them together, they come together in a certain pattern which generates certain responses. And it's I guess the fear of AI pairs with the creator fearing what they've created, whether it's like Sumerian gods, these humans are too noisy, we gotta drown them in a
Right.
flood and reboot the whole system, or this, like, Frank, a human creates a machine that betrays the human, scenario here. It is interesting to think about how one would treat how one would treat an artificial intelligence or some sort of quasi consciousness, only in respect to those connections, not to imply it as a soul or something like this, which starts to get tricky. But it is, maybe it reveals in us whether we are prone to treating new things as threats, or new things as possible friends. Maybe that's a distinctive feature.
Yeah, and being the human doing the creating, it is always a fascinating story. It's funny you said that, because I just finished, when you were talking about how I just finished Clark's Children of the Gods. Oh no, sorry, Children of the Gods. Now you've got me talking about Sumerian conspiracy theories. What's it called? Childhood's End,
Oh,
by
okay.
Arthur C. Clarke. Yeah,
I
and
don't know if
Clark,
I've read that, but I've definitely seen the title.
it's so good. It basically holds up. I won't spoil anything, but it's a short read too. I think it's 200 something pages, but it gets by so quickly. And I read it years ago, and I was doing some AI stuff, and I was kind of along the same thread. But the story for part of 2001 from Kubrick for the film doesn't really come from Clark's book 2001. Part of it comes from Childhood's End and a short story
Oh,
called
okay.
the called The Sentinel, which I just restarted this morning while I was walking with the kids on Audible. And yeah, I think that's only like 20 something minutes long to read or to listen to, but it's a short story. But yeah, it's kind of the same idea. And in Childhood's End, I won't ruin it, but it goes through conceptions of utopia that get created for humans again, and then thinking about that idea of progeny and childhood and humans creating things, what that means and what that means for this idyllic garden that gets created for the humans in a way. So I could see parallels there with Shelley's work. Do you know the story behind Frankenstein and Frankenstein's monster? Like,
Like a bunch of guys got together for like I don't know, in some castle or something. They had a competition
yeah.
about who can write an interesting story or something, and I think
Yeah,
hers was the
that's what I've
only
heard
one which
too.
resulted, or yeah.
No, there was another one that came out. Was it
Oh, there was. Okay.
one of the Bronte sisters, I believe,
Oh, okay.
was
Well,
there as well, I
I'll
think.
have to relook.
Because yeah, it was Percy Shelley, Mary Shelley. Was it Lord Byron, I think, was the held the party, and he was a notorious kind of a philanderer and had a good time in life and died young as a result. But interesting guy. Yeah, I think he threw the party, and yeah, that was the challenge, and it was a dark and stormy night kind of a thing. Yeah, I love that thread there. That's really interesting. Frankenstein and AGI, human creations. But yeah, and just tying that back to mythology, I think there's a lot there. Hephaestus and Vulcan and all of that. And if you think of Yahweh from the kind of more historical critical side, there's lots of interesting research into the origins of Yahweh now, and there are attempts to sort of locate that in sort of northern Arabia, southern Sinai, where there was copper mining and copper smelting, and still copper mines today. And we know that there were these kinds of like Vulcan type gods, who were god of storms and volcanoes, but also of metallurgy. And perhaps part of that tradition came out of that, if you're into that. I'm not saying people have to be, but I find it very compelling and very interesting, just from a history of religions point of view. So when yeah, I think when you think about that notion of creating and metalworking and mechanical stuff and how it relates to us humans, whether it's the wheel or a silicon chip, I think there's a lot there between our notions of ourselves and divinity.
Also makes me think of the Deus ex machina in Greek theater, where one way to resolve an intricate story, well, just have the god and machine, to reset the board, reset the board
Yoink,
as
pull them
required.
out, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, it's always fun to see, and that pops up now, in Avengers movies, and you're like, wait, they're doing first it's the hero's journey, and now they're going to do Deus Ex Machina. That's great.
Yes.
But
That's for sure.
no, I love that. That's good. And so
Cool.
you did Frankenstein. Anything else lately?
I have started to resume looking into this. There's a French biologist, Olivier Hamant, Hamant, and from his studies, he argues that like nature is not designed to be high performance or optimized, as it were, but nature designs for a robustness or resilience, the ability to have a setback and keep surviving. And of course, it's not like a conscious thing by nature. It's rather the vicissitudes of life, which is subject to all sorts of problems. It's not the most efficient, it's not the people who optimize for the good times who survive. It's the structures that are robust and able to like take a real walloping, but still manage to recover, as opposed to being completely keeled over. And so that again, that goes back to the comment I had on your paper about Design should privilege adaptability over rigid optimization. To use the words, or to do a translation of the fellow's words, it's like optimization fragilizes, it embrittles things. And so, particularly with the expectation, the inevitability of worse disasters, like climate-related stuff, with the reality of, like, now with software, you can probably do a lot more damage to someone's electric grid or other things like that. The additional fact that, we had a lot of infrastructure built, which was probably built to like the extremes of 1951 to 1980, things like that. We've had a lot of time, societally focused on efficiency, and there is some positive value, but I would wonder if the pendulum now swings to like, hey, we have to buckle down for more serious disruptions. And I think there's merit. I'm eager to read through this fellow's other work. We've traded a couple emails. He does have an English translation of his of a textbook from French, and has this beautiful title, called The Benefits of Imperfection, Biology, Society, and Beyond. And it makes me think of, academic pricing, I think it's $180 or something like this, but it makes me think of the American, wasn't there some like cracked bell, and then the Graham, Benjamin Franklin story? Hey, we could use this as, this bell is imperfect, that's why our project is to like make a better society, something like that. There's like a Liberty Bell, maybe, something like this. Anyway, the
Maybe,
French
yeah.
biologist, it's an interesting alternate viewpoint. Maybe the analogy would be that the efficiency focus is like the three synoptics, kind of dominate stuff. And here comes this other guy with a radically different view, saying, hey, what if it's robustness, really? And that would be like the Johannine text.
Right, yeah, or yeah, John with all the additions, or Mark with the tecton ending that changes the whole book. No, that's exactly what I'm trying to say in that paper, is that as we think about AI, both on the physical level of the minerals and water resources, but also ontologically, like, what do we need to do to build in not just efficiency but resilience, robustness for us and for whatever we're creating here. I keep going back to empathy in my own work. There was a great person I followed named Edith Stein, who, long story, she basically converted to become a Carmelite nun towards the end of her life. But she was a leading phenomenologist in the early 20th century. But she was Jewish, by culture, so she was wrapped up and killed during the Holocaust. So yeah, horrible, horrible story. Even after she converted, and now she's a saint. She was one of the patron saints of Europe, I believe, now as of 1996. But she wrote this great book called The Science of the Cross. So my whole work was called The Ecology of the Cross, kind of in honor of her. But she has incredible work on empathy, kind of from a phenomenological point of view. So it's like, how do you and I relate, and how do me and this rock relate? It's a thing to sort of focus on when we think about these things. But to me, I think that sort of idea of efficiency, the was amplified. A couple months ago, we get the Department of Government Efficiency here with Elon Musk, of all people, in charge of it, right? So even culturally, that notion of efficiency, was on full display, and we saw how it didn't go so well for Trump or Elon or that.
The
And
many people who got ousted, yeah.
yeah, and then one of the guys who was Elon's, one of his lieutenants, who made the news a couple times over the last few months, he was evidently assaulted and beat up pretty badly.
Oh yeah,
And
I heard that. It was on the news there.
yeah, so Donald Trump was upset and put out a number of messages about it, obviously. But people did not like Doge. So I think efficiency as a thing, between corporate America speak and that, and just the realization that the way things are going maybe aren't the best. I think we're going to start looking at words like redundancy and resilience and those words as more guideposts, I hope.
Right. Yeah,
So
I've used
that.
the analogy sometimes. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry, go ahead.
Okay,
Just drinking some
I've
water.
used the analogy a few times in terms of like energy thinking and reducing our emissions, that like we had this beautiful test case, this sort of A/B test, when Europeans were trying to reach the South Pole, right? There was what it was Scott was from the United Kingdom, and not Amundsen, Norwegian dude.
Yeah, that's it,
And I
right?
remember that, and Munson had prepared super cautiously, absolute redundancy. Everyone had one of those little altimeter things. Everyone had to use them. They had done little test runs. He spent time with the Inuit in the far north to try and figure out, how would I survive in the South Pole. And so they brought enormous amount of supplies. They budgeted very carefully, and as it turned out, things went pretty well for them. Everyone survived. They barely had a they barely had any stress points, really. I think one of the things was they would like ski for 4 days and then rest a full day. That way, if there was a storm, they could just use that day as a rest day, and everything would proceed apace. And Scott was more efficient in that he didn't leave out nearly as many food depots or as much excess material. And so, like, what happened is that Amundsen succeeded very wastefully. Like, I don't know, 16 out of 17 tons of food went unused, or there's some crazy number. And Scott failed efficiently. Like, he was so efficient, he couldn't handle, like, he died a few hundred meters from some food depot, but he couldn't see it because it was a blizzard, and they'd done some preparations for, worst case scenarios, but they weren't pessimistic enough. Like, if they had approached this very big project with a lot of like redundancies and contingencies, maybe they would have succeeded. Amundsen did. And I think one concern about trying to decarbonize is that if you put everything into one basket, on any topic, if anything happens to that basket, then you're kind of hooped, right? I think Trump has tried to block all new solar and wind projects, for example, across the states. That's not probably not the thing you're gonna expect to have to face, but life has a remarkable ability to hit you from where you least expect it, and being super cautious and maybe a little paranoid about, okay, we got to be able to deal with these situations. Let's plan for it, even if it is a bit, quote unquote, wasteful. I think would be a prudent approach.
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful analogy. I love that story. I somehow with my son who's 9, we ended up on a documentary about that a couple of weeks
Oh,
ago.
really? Wow.
Random, Saturday morning, he was up early, I was up early, and I was like, "You want to watch something?" So we pitched through the documentary section because he's a big history and big war nerd right now, as lots of 9 and 10 year olds are. But yeah, anything history he loves. So we watched that, and I knew the bare bones of the story, but I hadn't thought about it, and certainly not in that connection. But yeah, because I mean, you hear it so often that you just kind of pave over it, where whether it's my partner, but wife is a teacher, and they had a whole thing on efficiency in the classroom the other day, and that term has really seeped into the culture so much that now it's political and biting, and it's not seen as a necessarily a good thing all the time. So yeah, wow, that's a good thread to hit right there at the end. I like that. Efficiency as a torture of Frankenstein's monster, I think. So did you have sympathy for the monster at the end?
I very much did. I think I had sympathy for the monster the whole way through. Maybe part of the
Yeah.
reason the story is famous is because it's not just, I don't know, it's not like a Terminator where, you have this non-human thing which just starts killing stuff. You see this, I don't know, a pathos maybe. It's well thought out, and it's not It's not just about getting that, that big one scene, but it explores, I think, accurately how something which isn't human, but which is, not liked by humans, might try to struggle with doing things. And so it's a valid reason for it to be, a well-known or a timeless story, when, I don't know, the Pulp Fiction version of it, might just be forgotten.
Exactly. No, it's funny you say that because I'm thinking back now to a lot of times when I had or other teachers had students read Frankenstein, and it was always one of those I think 10th, 11th, maybe 12th grade AP Lit literature type
Okay,
classes.
yeah.
And I remember a couple of times students would come and we would talk about it because they know I'm into sci-fi and that kind of stuff, fantasy.
Yeah.
And they're like, "What is this book?" And then by the end, they're like, "Mr. Harrelson, this book has ruined horror movies forever. Like, I can't think now about Freddy Krueger without thinking of this monster because,
Wow,
we
okay,
helped
that's
create that, and it's like, wow, okay." And they're like, "No, but Frankenstein is supposed to be evil, and the monster's name is Frankenstein, not the,
Right. Yeah.
So it's all these things that we layer on top, and it's like, yeah,
Yeah.
if you don't just watch TikTok or Instagram Reels, there's
Yeah.
some really cool deep stuff out there. But
That's for sure.
well, Matthew, thank you for your time. I appreciate
Well,
hopping on
thanks for
here.
yours as well. This has been great. I probably have a few anime suggestions for you afterwards, but you're probably pretty close to your dinner time and so forth right now, so.
But yeah, no, we'll hop off. I'll put those in the list if you've got any for people listening. But I'll go ahead and stop this. If you want to get the extra, you'll have to listen next time.
Okay.